We'll talk this hour with the author of Stay, The History of Suicide and the Philosophies Against It. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. In the U.S., more people kill themselves each year than die in car accidents, and rates are increasing among middle-aged Americans and young people worldwide. And our guest, after losing two friends to suicide, went on a quest to research its history and the arguments against it. Do you think suicide is ever acceptable for someone else? Do you think that people have the right to take their own life? Or do you agree with our guest that suicide is simply wrong, even from a secular point of view? We will hear the arguments against suicide. We will welcome your questions, your arguments, your experiences. Has suicide touched your life? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Let me welcome our guest. Jennifer Michael Hecht is a poet, historian, author of several books. Her most recent is Stay, The History of Suicide and the Philosophies Against It. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So why did the suicides of your friends prompt you to research the history of suicide?
Well, one thing is that they happened about 2 years apart, so I had a lot of time to think about what I was experiencing after the first one, and then when the second one happened, I was upset, and they were both poets, as am I, and so I wrote a blog post just sort of asking people. I was thinking mostly about the other poets who would read this blog. It's called The Best American Poetry. It's not just mine. To not kill themselves, and to not kill themselves partially energized by this, by the sadness that they felt with these two suicides. That we were all still reeling from the second one. Wonderful poet Rachel Whetstone, and everybody, there was this outpouring on the web about it, and I was asking people to turn that inwards and to see that if Rachel thought she was a burden, or if anyone thinks they're a burden, they're not thinking straight, because the comparison of the burden of their suicide would be so much worse, because it makes us all feel so sad and so much of a loss of a sense of meaning in life. And I was really just asking my friends and the people I didn't know who I had so much in common with to stay. But then that blog post went sort of viral, and the Boston Globe printed it in their ideas section, and I really realized that I'd hit on something that I needed to think more clearly about and check all my assumptions, and that's what the research was. But I'll add that I have my own dark times, too, and I'm not a religious person at all, and I needed to figure out a way for myself to not have to feel those feelings.
Yeah, and a lot of the book is not necessarily the religious moral reasons against suicide, but secular reasons.
Yeah, the vast majority of the book, I just cite the religious ones to be clear that some of the great religious thinkers also offered some secular reasons, the two secular reasons that I champion, which is one, it's a terrible thing to do to your community, meaning your friends, your family, people who are sort of like you. We have great statistical evidence these days that show that when a suicide happens and it's reported, that age and gender tends to have more suicides. And people who also just have some connection with the suicide, a profession in common, or some secret thing we'll never know. But somehow the first suicide gave permission or even encouraged the next one. Mm-hmm. And so I say in the book that if you want your niece to make it through her dark night, you have to make it through yours.
Yeah, so we owe it to our future selves to stay alive.
That's the other part of it, we think of ourselves as integrated selves. We're the same person all the time. But much of the time, we recognize that, you know, when we're hungry, we're not hungry, we fall in love, we fall out of love, we get depressed, we get happy. Our moods change to to an extraordinary degree, and they have us do different things. And when you think about things that way, you often see that suicide is letting one mood murder all the others. There are cases where people are suicidal all the time and for years, but they are extraordinarily rare. We have all sorts of documentation that shows that suicide is usually a pretty short-term impulse. And when people are thwarted in their suicide attempts, we've got a good study that showed 94% go on to, 26 years later are still alive or died of natural causes. Another way of looking at it is thinking of a past self of yourself, and whether while they were working towards their degree or working towards forging the relationships they've made or these sorts of things, how they would have felt if they knew they were going to come to this end. And really to allow this to create a barrier. We put up barriers on certain suicide bridges, and they work. People don't just go to another bridge. They go home. Mm-hmm. And we've done a lot of other very simple fix barriers, including the UK stopped selling acetaminophen in large amounts. They make a small amount package, and you have to and they're in bubble wrap. And of course someone could still buy them and do pop them out, but they don't. The suicide rate dropped. So we know that a little bit of protection put in, on by the society or by yourself can get you through these terrible moments and on to a moment where you'll be very grateful that you're still alive. We also have great evidence for that.
And you also think a strong argument against suicide is suffering makes us better people. How so?
Well, philosophers and artists through history have talked about this, and of course, religion talks about it too, but they put it in terms of God a lot of the time, not all the time. But many people who have suffered, many people who are extremely famous for courage in one way or another, speak about their periods of suffering as periods where they gained a kind of strength. And it's not a simple strength. One of the things it is humility. It's possible for us to come out of childhood feeling very powerful, which is good in some ways, but it doesn't let us see how many other people are experiencing life. And suffering gives us the humility to be able to see beyond our own scope. We don't even understand all the ways that it works, but philosopher after philosopher, artist after artist talk about how their periods of misery, while almost unbearable while they were going through them, led them to a place of greater insight, greater calm, greater maturity, greater generosity. And that's a powerful statement that most periods in time have been more aware of than we are. We're just so interested in getting rid of pain. And believe me, if I could get rid of everybody's suicidal feelings and everybody's psychic pain, I would do it. And we would, we would find our wisdom elsewhere. But we can't just get rid of these things. And so we might as well listen to them. We might as well remember, even if it's in the tiniest part of our mind and heart, that this is doing us some good. If we just have to hang on. And some days, your whole job is to not die. That's okay. That happens to people. We need to voice that.
Yeah. I'm thinking of someone who I know who attempted suicide. I'm, for the mm-hmm. sake of this person's privacy, I won't go into too many details, but he is, he still suffers psychic pain. He's got sure. a mental illness, and he's sure. Goes in and out of psychotic depression. And
sure.
Doesn't he have a right to say the pain is too much? I just can't go through this anymore.
Well, there's a couple ways of looking at this. One thing is, I certainly don't believe that someone who has a dire, fatal, painful illness has to keep living. I don't even see that as suicide. I see that as managing the way that one dies by cancer. Okay, and making it less painful because that's what's happening. And there are levels of psychic pain where even doctors agree with you that you're in an unbearable state and that it seems to last. When you can get a couple of people to agree that you're in an unbearable place that isn't worth going on, well, then that's a case that has to be adjudicated on its own terms. But that is not the case for most people who kill themselves. A tremendous number of young people kill themselves every year, teenagers and people in their 20s. More people in the Army, and most of them are under 20, killed themselves last year than died in combat. The college campus rate is unparalleled. It's never been this high so long as we've been counting. The skyrocketing of this thing makes us have to step back and say, look, in the last 10 years, 10 years ago, the suicide rate shocked observers by hitting 30,000. And about a year ago, it shocked observers by almost hitting 40,000.
So what's going on?
Well, I think that there are other ways of looking at this, but the economic downturn, of course, did not help. Many people have always taken general misery very personally and seen themselves as failures. But this thing started before the economic downturn, and it's also worldwide. So I think that in the United States, there are many different reasons, but that part of it is that this thing is somewhat of, I don't mean to be crass by using the word fad, but once it starts, more people have heard of it and more people do it. I've seen other people in the media, respected mental health professionals, say that one of the reasons the baby boomers may be having an explosion of suicide right now is because there was also a rise in suicide when they were teenagers, and that these people are still responding to that which happened decades ago. I feel the number of people in the Army who've told me that the suicides they knew came in groups, it just makes me feel intuitively in the same way that I see all the epidemiological and sociological and psychological statistics show, which is when one person does it, more people do it. And eventually, in a certain profession or at a certain time, you can get into a snowball effect where people are doing it more because of that. We also have a lot of evidence that when parents do it, children are much more likely to do it at some point in their lives. And we know that this isn't just about mental health issues, because those aren't inherited into suicide unless there's a suicide first. And we have individual people who tell us about this. Spalding Gray, before he killed himself, jumping off the Staten Island Ferry, he talked about his mother's suicide and how he often felt she was calling to him from across the grave, that he felt drawn to suicide because of this. And we see other personal evidence for that in the way the poet John Berryman talked about his father's suicide. We can look at the Hemingway family, and yes, there are ways in which mental illness, either through biology or through family culture, can be brought on into the next generation. But suicide itself can be resisted, and most mental health professionals will say so. We have way too much of an idea in our culture now that suicide is a sort of inevitable endpoint of a mental illness. So it's the end of a stage of a disease. And it simply can't be the case if, for some reason, 10,000 more people a year are doing it now, especially because we've never had more drugs and opportunities for therapy, mm-hmm. Certainly more psychogenic drugs. And meanwhile, the suicide rate is going up. So this is not just mental health. This is also culture, society.
We are talking with Jennifer Michael Hecht. She is a poet, a historian, the author of many books. Her most recent is Stay, The History of Suicide and the Philosophies Against It. And that's what we're talking about, arguments against suicide, arguments for staying alive. And we welcome your questions, your views, your experiences at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Curdine. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking with Jennifer Michael Hecht, author of Stay, The History of Suicide and the Philosophies Against It. And we welcome your story, your question, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Abby in Altoona is with us first. Hello, Abby.
Hi. First off, I've got three family members very close to me that have killed themselves. My dad was about 65, and he was definitely depressed at the time and had kind of gone through writing letters before but had gotten found out. But he didn't have a totally depressed life. My nephew was in his later 20s, and he had schizophrenia, and I'm sure that was part of the reasons why he committed suicide. And my son committed suicide a little over 2 years ago, and I agree with some of the things your guest is saying.
I'm sorry. I'm so sorry, Abby. I knew that some emotions were going to be raised during this hour, but you're concerned about what we're talking about.
I know it already has a big stigma about it. People can't talk about it very easily. And I don't want it to be more stigmatized than it already is. I agree with a lot of what your guest is saying, but there's just a lot of things that I think.
Abby, I'm sorry. Why do you think our guest encouraging people to stay alive is adding to the stigma of suicide?
It's not encouraging them to stay alive. It's just at that time, I believe that they are in such a black hole that I don't think you can just say I can get through this. This is just a stage of my life. Their depression or whatever they're going through at that time. I mean, who would really want to end their life? I don't think for the majority of people that end their life with a gunshot, nobody in their right mind would do that. I think. Unless they're so gone already.
First of all, my condolences. I'm so sorry, and it's a terrible thing. And I really understand the feeling that in some cases it was inevitable. This is what they were going through. I do say in the book that suicide is wrong. And I don't say it by myself. I say it with the backing of many philosophers and thinkers of art and artists through history, because I think it's important for that to be out there. My main idea here is to express gratitude for those who manage to stay and do so for the sake of the people around them and for the love of life and for the commitment to humanity and to staying alive. The ones we've lost, it's just a heartbreak. And I am sorry, genuinely, for the idea that the ideas that I'm putting out there might add a little to the stigma in terms of me saying it's wrong. Exceptions to everything that's wrong. A person who steals a loaf of bread to feed their starving family isn't so wrong, but stealing is still wrong. And I thought deeply about it and decided that I want to save the ones I still might save, and that I believe this, and that many great thinkers have believed it, and most periods in history have had a much stronger sense of taboo against suicide, a much stronger sense that it's wrong and that you should fight as hard as you can against it than we do. And so I felt it was important to at least make sure that everybody knew the arguments against it. I personally have found them helpful, so that instead of when I sometimes think of this, which happens to me, I'm able to just put it aside in a way that I can't put aside the thoughts, I can't put aside the bad feelings, but I can put aside the rational part of me that thinks I might do it. No, I'm not going to. I've decided against it in a way that
look, people want to kill other people sometimes, but most people have enough of a pre-written rule in their mind that homicide is wrong that they never, ever even think about actually carrying it out. So the thing is, I have tremendous sympathy, and neither do I want people to feel stigmatized, but I do think that it's wrong. I do think that we owe people gratitude for staying, and that that is a great gift that we can give to each other in our pain, to remember that we are of value to people even when we feel we're not. And I know that some people are in terrible psychic pain. I just also know that a good portion of that is feeling like you're a burden. Yeah. That you feel useless and sad and tired and miserable, but you also feel, what good am I doing the world? And I don't want one depressed person to feel like they have to justify their existence on their own. I want them to see that culture and society and great minds have already decided that it's better with you here. We need you. We need each other. And we believe each other into being. And you should do everything you can to stay, and you don't have to figure it out yourself. You're not more of a burden than your suicide would be. Stay, period. And if I can help somebody through that, I'm going to try. Again, it's not all my idea. I'm bringing forward into our moment ideas that have run through 3,000 years of history.
Yeah. Abby, do you have anything else you want to say?
No, I appreciate her words. I do. I just don't want it to be like a, I don't want people to think that it's a selfish act. I don't necessarily think it is a selfish act.
I don't think so either.
Yeah, you don't think it's selfish, Jennifer?
Well, I think that most people haven't been told that this is profoundly important to everybody else. And I think that that's the message that has to get out. You know, if you've been told, if you've really deeply thought about how you're going to hurt other people and you've read about it and you know about it, well, then maybe it is selfish. But most people haven't. Most people, and we know this from all sorts of different sources, including suicide notes and confessions of people who have survived, that it never quite occurred to them that they felt so bad that they thought it was the right thing to do. And that's what I think is important. I think, no, for most people, it's not so selfish because they really didn't know. Nobody, the culture's been laying down on the job, and we gave this whole thing to religion and said, God says not to do it. And if you either don't believe in God or don't believe in a God who's paying attention to that sort of thing or believe that God will forgive you, then that gives you no support. But I sympathize tremendously, and I certainly hope that what I'm doing is that doesn't hurt anyone who's mourning.
Thank you, Abby, for the call and our condolences. So our next caller is Cammie in Madison. Hello, Cammie.
Hi. I sort of agree with the previous caller, but I guess my question is, you know, how do you reach those people who are in those really dark states who aren't seeking help? I think that message that the guest Jennifer is spreading, this sort of awareness, is really could be really helpful for some people. But I wonder for people where they're in those really dark states, what can you do?
Jennifer.
Look, the first thing is, I definitely think it's important to reach people before they're in that dark state or in between dark states. When you're in that worst place, it's very hard to take any new information in. However, that first blog post I wrote that the Boston Globe printed on a single blue page, I still get emails, this is years later, of people who tell me that they slip it under the door of someone that they love, with this sense of at least tell them that they're tremendously loved and that they're that other people aren't thinking that they're useless or a burden. So I do think that there are ways of at least expressing that to somebody who's in a terrible dark place. But I certainly think that it's much easier to reach people when they're calm and in their calm mind. And I'm certain, because I've been told by other people, that calm mind is capable of containing what you know, some people in history have almost called this imp in us that wants to kill ourselves. You know, it that is a containable urge. Of course, there are people who are beyond, and for them, we have to have certain kinds of sympathy and understand it as an extreme case. But if you're the only one who thinks that you should kill yourself, you probably shouldn't. Everybody needs you. They love you. People who don't even know you are associating with you. And there's always more good you could do in this world, even if just by testifying to that darker side of life, to staying with us, getting through this, loving yourself, knowing that many great people have gone through this sort of thing, hanging on. And then when you come out the other side, you're going to be a more powerful person because you're going to be able to help other people and tell them you got through this. And when you meet those people, it'll make life worth having lived. I just hear it from too many people that's how they experienced it.
Kyle on Facebook says, what about severe poverty? I survived a suicide attempt, and I don't regret my attempt. Mm-hmm. I will always keep it an open option.
Mm. Yeah, extreme poverty is terrible because it's not just the physical aspect of it, but we tend to blame ourselves even when the whole culture is going through it. The suicide rate went up in the last Great Depression, you can think, couldn't those people see they were in a historic moment of difficulty? For the most part, historic moments of difficulty do keep people alive, so that the suicide rate almost always goes down during war. The wars of this last decade have not brought the suicide rate down, and that's upsetting, and we think of that in terms of the isolation of the modern soldier. Soldiers, for just one thing, used to live in barracks. Now many of them have their rooms, their own television in the room, and there are other things about technology that make the soldier who used to feel in a tight group feel more isolated. But the rest of the culture also, the rest of the country also, the suicide rate used to go down during war because we felt bonded together. We felt our problems were more communal. And poverty today, the way we talk about it in the U.S. especially, can be particularly self-stigmatizing. One feels that one has failed instead of being able to realize, oh, we're all in this together, not all of us, but 99% of us, right? And to realize this. Again, individual people are going to have different experiences, but the aggregate shows that people usually do regret the suicide, usually are grateful. Even if sometimes they don't regret the attempt because it taught them how much they love life. Nevertheless, they're glad they lived. And we know that from many, many different sources, including people who jumped off bridges and survived, tell us that moments after they jumped, they thought all my problems were bearable except that I just jumped off this bridge. We know from myriad 911 phone calls, people who've just taken a bottle of pills and a bottle of alcohol and realize then that they don't want to die. And sometimes it takes that kind of extreme action, but isn't that something we can also do conceptually? Isn't there a way we can bond together and help each other through it just by talking this thing out a little bit? And no, we're not going to save everyone, but more people are dying these days of suicide than in most historic moments that we've had any kind of ability to check, and that means some of those people can be saved. But I sympathize tremendously with both the agony of poverty and the mental aspect of it, which is terrible. And the only way for us to not feel so isolated and not to blame ourselves is to speak about it.
Fred in Palmyra is with us now. Hi, Fred.
Good morning. I missed a little bit of the show getting in and out of my vehicles, but your guest said something about society sleeping on the job, and that sort of related to my question. Suicide seems to make some people more famous, like Kurt Cobain, Ernest Hemingway, Sylvia Plath, and a number of others who became quite famous. And it's—I don't know if that's gives one of these signs of its acceptance? Perhaps your guest has already addressed that, but if not, I'll take my answers off the air.
Do famous people glamorize suicide?
Yeah, they do. Mm-hmm. We have statistical evidence that shows this. Now, Kurt Cobain is a very interesting case because we knew so much about this problem that a famous, beloved suicide causes more suicides, that Seattle, where he lived, did a tremendous outreach to people about this as soon as it happened, and that suicide rate didn't jump. So it works. You can talk about this to the point where you help. Now, rate of suicide phone calls to the hotline, that did jump. So people were feeling it. But because the society had already set up a little bit of a net, that meant that we were people didn't actually carry it out. But we do have evidence that after Marilyn Monroe died, the suicide rate jumped, that it usually is associated with age and gender, but that other ages and genders jump a little bit too. And yes, I think that if you are in the public eye, it is part of your responsibility to you know, not everybody takes up that responsibility. We have people who know that they're famous and role models and don't want to take on that role of showing a good way to live, of showing resilience, of showing love, of showing responsibility. And nobody can force them to, but I certainly think that when you're a beloved author or actor or musician, that people follow what you do, and that should go into not just this prohibition against doing it, but the realization of how important you are, of how much you're loved. But we have to be able to feel with the same strength of misery that we feel when someone we love has done this. We have to be able to feel the flip side, which means you're keeping people alive when you stay alive. You're doing this great service. And we have to find a way to express gratitude, you know, if only by this book, but I'm doing what I can. I believe we need to thank each other for sometimes thinking of what it does to the community and thereby rejecting it. And doing what Plato and Aristotle and so many philosophers through history have suggested, and that is to try to get through the dark night.
We are talking with Jennifer Michael Hecht. She is author of Stay, The History of Suicide and the Philosophies Against It. She argues that suicide is morally wrong from a secular point of view because it does so much damage to one's community. It creates lifelong pain for someone's friends and family and loved ones. It can encourage others to take their own lives. And she says we owe it to ourselves, we owe it to our future selves to survive. So she is arguing why it is wrong to commit suicide and giving us strong arguments for staying alive. And we welcome your questions. We welcome your views. We welcome your own experiences. Perhaps you have been touched by suicide. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. We are talking with Jennifer Michael Hecht. She is the author of Stay, The History of Suicide and the Philosophies Against It. And our next caller is Bill in Kenosha. Hello, Bill.
Good morning. My question is, the author and guest stated that there was an increase in suicides by 10,000, I believe she said. How is that statistically, a percentage of the population of the country or of the world in that fact, that everything is increasing, population is increasing, wouldn't that also increase the amount of suicides that occur? And is the percentage actually increasing?
Yeah, the percentage is definitely increasing. You're right, the population is increasing, but nowhere near by these kinds of leaps and bounds. You know, just a few little examples of things that people just don't seem to realize that suicide, there are more suicides than murders every year in the United States and worldwide. Suicide has killed more people every year, except for three worst years of the AIDS epidemic. Suicide kills more people than AIDS every year. Suicide
is one of the top three killers for people under about 45, and in the top 10 for the older set. The older set actually kills themselves more in real numbers, but by that age, some of the other diseases start to keep pace, so the percentage looks different. The real numbers are definitely increasing.
Janie on Facebook says, so afraid my two sons will take their lives as their father did at age 45. Oh, I'm so sad. My sons were 16 and 20 at the time, 16 years ago. It defines the rest of your life, and not in a good way. He was, and they are, the most wonderful human beings. And you say that Janie might have reason to be concerned.
Yes. There's definitely statistical evidence to say that one should be concerned, but as I've been noting, there's a tremendous amount that talking and being open about this can do. But in my experience, for what I can say, the stories and the arguments that I learned in writing Stay have given me a tremendous amount of strength, which I feel I've been able to share with people who email me and tell me that these stories and these arguments that I've collected from throughout history are able to change the perspective on this thing, so that instead of seeing the pull towards suicide, one can feel the great purpose in life that being committed to staying alive can be. And I know that can be the case. Even the great philosopher, one of my favorites, Ludwig Wittgenstein, three out of four of his brothers killed themselves, and one of his cousins as well. And he was depressed, in and out of depressions his whole life. But he didn't kill himself. He didn't kill himself for two reasons. One, a reason about the meaning of life that he got from Schopenhauer 100 years earlier. And that shows that somebody else's ideas can make a difference. But Wittgenstein also came up with a beautiful little idea, which was, if suicide is not allowed, then if suicide is allowed, then everything is allowed. If anything is not allowed, then suicide is not allowed. But suicide is a kind of elementary sin. We usually think of murder or stealing as the elementary sin, because we think of, I don't mean sin, I mean crime, but we think of crime in terms of how it hurts other people. And Wittgenstein is here saying that believing the world into being, staying, being committed to life and meaning is the ultimate good that we can do, and that's why suicide looks like the ultimate bad. I definitely think hearing these stories throughout history of people struggling with those urges and coming to strong realizations, and I mean some wonderful novelists as well who put this in just gorgeous terms. Victor Hugo, for instance, talks about how suicide can be a homicide, and because of what it does to other people, because other people will follow you. And so it's a horrible burden that your sons have, and it's not fair. On the other hand, it is something that can animate a feeling of life having worth, even when you're not contributing much. Even in those times where you're feeling down or you're feeling useless, you can realize that you're doing this great contribution to yourself and to the future and to the people around you by holding on. And, you know, the one missing part is the culture's gratitude. And that's one of the things that, you know, I can't find anyone else saying in history, but I'm trying to say that. But I do think the stories in the book, just by themselves, seeing how many people think about this thing. Suicide, we act like it's just the severely mentally ill, but it's not. Many people have some sort of reversal in their lives, some sort of disappointment, and it takes them unawares. And some terrible disappointment kills them when, if they had been a little bit better prepped for it, they might have been able to save themselves. I definitely think that even though reporting about suicides can lead to more suicides, talking about suicides can stop it. We've seen that in many different cases, including high schools and colleges, where one suicide happens, you can predict that there are going to be more. But if you send people in to talk about it, that
rate does not skyrocket. So we really need to think about it.
Thanks very much to Janie for the email. Nancy emails, it's Heidi on Facebook who writes, "I survived a suicide attempt. I know the majority of people think what I did was shameful, and talking honestly about it is frowned upon. I disagree, though, with your guest. Everyone has the right to say enough. My feelings on their choice may differ, but my feelings are my responsibility, not another's."
Yeah, this is one of the, I sympathize, and this is one of the main opinions that are out there, and that this is why I wrote the book, because historically there have been, cultures have been much more warmly telling people to please stay. And what happened in our culture is very specific. The church in the Middle Ages became extremely anti-suicide. It started from compassionate arguments with Augustine and Thomas Aquinas, but with those arguments came a prohibition that God had laid down that you must not do this. And after a while, the church started actually torturing corpses, not allowing a family of a suicide to inherit the estate, and making that into an utterly shameful and horrible thing. And because of that, when the Enlightenment comes around, and even a little before the Enlightenment, people who think of themselves as rationalist, as progressive, were poised to reject the church's idea about this. But I think we went too far. And there are other ways where sometimes people have gone too far in saying, "I don't believe in religious prohibitions. I have the right to my life." And sometimes made their morality on the basis of rejecting that kind of control. And for that reason, sometimes rejected monogamy, rejected the ban against homicide, rejected other things, saying if there's no God, then there are no rules. But that's not the case. We get our morality from each other, from culture, from history, from our inner nature. And the idea that without religion, there are no bans on anything, we've chucked that out for most things. I think it's time to rethink this idea that everyone has a right to suicide. Obviously, everyone is going to have their own control of that to some degree. You know, guns in this country are the biggest problem. More than half of gun deaths in this country are suicide, and more than half of successful suicides are gun-related. So, obviously, this is just too easy. When England had the kind of ovens that you could just put your head in without even lighting it and you would get gassed, more people died. And when they changed those ovens, fewer people died. So there's no question that means can change things. And this business of it being everyone's right, that's what I learned coming up. That's what I thought was the progressive and reasonable and rational opinion. But I don't think that the right to kill yourself belongs on that same list as the right to speech and the right to determine your own happiness. I think we are, in fact, more profoundly connected to each other, and that I can't force anyone to believe this, but I do know that it can help a person who is miserable to at least have been exposed to the idea that it is not your right, that we all belong to each other, and that we have that you know, when you're born into the United States, you're born into its laws. And I believe that when you're born into humanity, you're born into some of its laws. And some of its laws, I'm talking about the most extreme. And I do believe that this idea that it's everybody's right has been overplayed. And I'm hoping that by showing how many brilliant people through history who've given a lot of thought to suicide have come out on the opinion that it's wrong. Durkheim is one of our first major, about 100 years ago, did the great study on suicide, which still guides the modern thinking about suicide. And his giant book was all about statistics and all about ideas about the reality of this thing. But in the very last pages, he thinks about what humanity is and what human beings are, and he says it's wrong.
Let me get another caller in from Jeannie in Racine. Hello, Jeannie.
Good morning. First off, I just wanted to express my heartfelt, sympathies to the caller, Abby, who called in earlier and, at her losses. And partly that was why I was calling. I've had two friends in the last 2 years who've lost beautiful young daughters that were very gifted and had a lot going for them, but they both suffered from bipolar disorder and severe depression. And this is really, you know, what took their life was the severe psychic pain that they were feeling and their depression. And I think it's a little bit simplistic to say, you know, just tell people to stay and tell people this is what they shouldn't do, because sometimes it's like beyond, really beyond their control, and it can leave the survivors feeling guilt, over more guilt than they may already feel, if they're made to feel like somehow if they had told them something different or done something differently like that, that would have prevented it, when in fact, you know, they may have been doing all that they could to try to prevent that suicide and couldn't.
Yeah. Look, if you come out with new fire laws that save lives, is that making the people who didn't do those previously guilty, or the number of people who die in the hospital of infections because we and people knew you had to wash your hands, but they didn't do it, or the doctors didn't do it all the time, and we've got new regulations that make it harder to avoid washing your hands, and people survive. Does that mean they should feel guilty for the past? I sympathize tremendously, and I don't want anyone to feel more guilt, but I also don't want more people to die than need to. And it's just plain erroneous. There's so many health professionals who say suicide is not inevitable in so many cases. Mm-hmm. The person doesn't necessarily, that suicide is an impulsive decision, that in many, many cases, if it's avoided, if you get through it, you are able to survive. Of course, I know that if someone takes their life, it's a little bit easier to bear if you think there was nothing that could have been done. And I'm sorry about that aspect. On the other hand, I want people who can live to live. And I feel I just want these ideas, which I found through history, and which I know have helped people, just as the prohibition by God helped people. We have all sorts of evidence of people understanding their mental anguish as a struggle between God and the devil, and they're able to fight back these impulses to die because they're able to conceptualize them as the devil, as wrong, and to fight towards God. Well, most people these days don't have that kind of conviction, that kind of belief, and they need to know, at least, that there is a cultural consensus, this huge argument through history of secular people saying that this is something that we can try to control and try to live for. Again, I know this is, you know, when I took it on, I knew it was going to be a tremendously emotional thing to do, and that some people were going to feel sort of angry about it. Nevertheless, I felt like it was an offering I had to make.
I'm glad that you joined us. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you.
Jennifer Michael Hecht is the author of Stay, A History of Suicide and the Philosophies Against It. Thanks to Christy Taylor and Marika Saval. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.